Stars Collide by Morning Black Star. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. I'm in Toronto, Canada today, where special elections were held earlier this month, delivering a slim majority in the House of Commons to the Liberal Party and Prime Minister Mark Carney, who will now have more latitude to advance his political agenda. Last year, Canada's Liberal Party soared in popularity as President Trump intensified his threats to make Canada the 51st state and impose tariffs. This is a video message released by Prime Minister Carney last week.
Security can't be achieved by ignoring the obvious or downplaying the very real threats that we Canadians face. So here's the current situation. The world, as I said earlier, is more dangerous and divided. The U.S. has fundamentally changed its approach to trade, raising its tariffs to levels last seen during the Great Depression. Many of our former strengths, based on our close ties to America, have become our weaknesses, weaknesses that we must correct. Workers in our industries most affected by U.S. tariffs, in autos, in steel, in lumber, are under threat. Businesses are holding back investments, restrained by the pall of uncertainty that's hanging over all of us. The U.S. has changed, and we must respond. Canada Strong is our plan to build Canada by Canadians, for Canadians.
Meanwhile, Canada's main progressive party, the National Democratic Party, or NDP, recently elected socialist activist, documentary filmmaker Avi Lewis as its new party leader. The NDP was once the main opposition in party Canada, but now holds just 5 seats in the House of Commons. Lewis campaigned on a platform of affordability, equity, and higher wealth taxes. The NDP will now have to rebuild. Avi Lewis comes from a prominent political family. His grandfather, David Lewis, helped found the NDP and led the party. And Avi Lewis's father, Stephen Lewis, led the Ontario NDP in the 70s. Stephen Lewis was also a human rights advocate, broadcaster, former Canadian ambassador to the United Nations, and special UN envoy on HIV/AIDS in Africa. Stephen Lewis died of cancer at the age of 88, just 2 days after Avi's election victory. This is Avi Lewis speaking at his father's memorial on Sunday.
Many of you know that the final months of Dad's journey coincided with my campaign for the leadership of Canada's NDP, our lifelong political home. And for those of you watching from around the world, it is a miracle to be able to tell you that the last thing he saw with open eyes in this life was our victory in that race and the passing of the political torch.
To talk about his election, his father, and more, we're joined now by Avi Lewis in Ottawa. First of all, Avi, our condolences on the death of your father, Stephen Lewis, a man we interviewed a number of times over the years. If you can talk about the trajectory of your family and what has brought you to this point as the new leader of Canada's new Democratic Party, the NDP.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you so much for those kind words. It has been obviously... The last month of my life has been just an extraordinary experience. I'm at a loss for words, which, as you know, in my family doesn't happen very often. I grew up in the NDP of the 1970s. And in a way, the sort of last moment in the post-war boom of public ownership and build out in Canada of our social safety net, our universal healthcare system, which the NDP was the founding force in bringing it from Tommy Douglas in Saskatchewan to a national level. It's our pride and joy. It's one of the main things that makes us different from the United States. You don't have to be rich to get sick in Canada, although the privatization efforts have accelerated and our healthcare system is not what it used to be. It's really these kinds of accomplishments and that period of the 1970s was when I was, you know, I was a kid, but I grew up in the party. My life, as you know, because we've talked many times over the years, has been devoted to activism, came up in the globalization movement when we were fighting these free trade deals that would integrate Canada's economy so tightly with the United States that now we're in an era of Trump stomping around the world, acting with impunity, shredding international norms and attacking Canada, threatening to annex us and levying these massive economic attacks in the form of tariffs. We are you know, we were always right to say that we should never integrate our economy so deeply with the United States. But now we have to figure out how to Trump-proof our economy, how to create an independent economy. And this is a very, it's a unique and historic moment for me. I've been running for office for a few years unsuccessfully, but I won the leadership of the NDP at the low point in the electoral cycle, but at a pivotal moment in Canada's history when we need concrete proposals for how to make our economy more independent and how to protect the basic social safety net and the values of solidarity and community that are, you know, our storied Canadian difference. So it's a very it's a momentous time. The NDP has a lot of rebuilding to do. But, you know, we ran a campaign that was really forthright as the Carney government was elected. And Carney's a central banker. And so, you know, his first job was at Goldman Sachs. But he was elected as a kind of Canadians felt that he would be the progressive protector of Canada in the Trump era. He's moved very fast to the right. He's advanced a project of doubling down on resource extraction of oil and gas pipelines and of massive infrastructure projects that will largely benefit foreign corporations, fast-tracking them, sidelining Indigenous rights, sidelining environmental consultation. And the Conservatives under Pierre Poilievre have voted with him on many of these big big items. And so the NDP has a wide open political space now to advance real solutions for a cost of living crisis in a country where a handful of corporations dominate every sector of our economy and they're jacking up prices and rents and mortgages are completely out of control and unaffordable. I think the affordability crisis is even worse in Canada than the United States because there's such tight control of a handful of corporations over groceries, cell phones and telecommunications, the oil sector, big banks in Canada. You know, so we have advanced really populist left agenda, a heat pump in every home, an east-west electricity grid, an electric bus revolution, a public option for groceries and public ownership in telecoms and many sectors of the economy, and a huge build out of public housing. We need non-market solutions to a time of market failure. And we've struck a chord. Our base is growing fast. And now we've got to reach out to the whole country and grow a political movement in a time of crisis.
And Avi, could you talk about how your party, the NDP, fits into this broader political and ideological landscape, especially given the fact that the party in recent elections suffered a big defeat?
Yeah, we had a high point about 15 years ago when Jack Layton was our leader and we broke through, especially in Quebec, and became the official opposition for the first time. And over the last 15 years, we've been going down and down in the NDP. We have failed to connect with working class voters in Canada who have been, you know, like in the United States and around the world, have been, you know, there's a lot of successful rage harvesting on the political right, punching down and blaming immigrants and, you know, trans folks for society's problems, which have obviously been created by the incredible extraction of wealth by the 0.01% who now dominate our economy as working class life gets impossible. And so we have to get those folks back. And we're at the low point of the electoral cycle, as I said, but the space for us to move is enormous. And I think young people in particular are really responding to a vision where life just doesn't have to be so grindingly unfair. And, in a rich country, a country awash in wealth, but we need a party that's going to say, we need wealth taxes. We need to go and get all that wealth, or at least a significant chunk of it, that is stuck at the top of society and actually put it behind things that will improve the daily life of Canadians. Public transit that actually works. Public housing that is beautiful and affordable and not governed by speculation. And we gotta take on the tech bros who dominate our economy like they dominate the global economy. So we came out right away when I was first leader and came to Ottawa for the first time with a call for the government to ban surveillance pricing, which is happening now in states across the country. We've got a human first AI policy where we're calling for a moratorium on data centers, much as Bernie Sanders is doing in the States. And I think there is a common surge in democratic socialist politics, which is really speaking to people's everyday emergencies of just trying to get by in an economy that is completely impossible and rigged in favor of the rich. And I'm very optimistic about our chances in Canada. Right now, I don't have proof points, you know, in the polls. We've got five seats in the House of Commons. But I can feel something shifting in politics. It is underneath the mainstream radar. The corporate media wants to declare us on life support in a death spiral. Every day is another story about how the NDP is toast. And yet, in the leadership campaign, we signed up tens of thousands of new members in every single part of this country. We set fundraising records for the NDP in the leadership race. And we won on the first ballot in a ranked ballot system with the largest margin and the largest absolute votes of any NDP leadership campaign in history, including Jack Layton when he was first elected leader. So there's something going on here up here in Canada. Don't romanticize it as Americans too often do. But we are building like Zoran Mamdani is building, like Bernie and others are building, and we're very optimistic.
Abby Lewis, I want to turn to the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney speaking in Davos at the World Economic Forum in January.
We knew the story of the international rules-based order was partially false, that the strongest would exempt themselves when convenient, that trade rules were enforced asymmetrically. And we knew that international law applied with varying rigor depending on the identity of the accused or the victim. This fiction was useful, and American hegemony in particular helped provide public goods, open sea lanes, a stable financial system, collective security, and support for frameworks for resolving disputes. So we placed the sign in the window. We participated in the rituals. And we largely avoided calling out the gaps between rhetoric and reality. This bargain no longer works.
The former banker, the Canadian Prime Minister, sounds like he could be you, Avi Lewis. What does he actually mean? I mean, this is a speech that caught the world's attention. And what are you countering it with at the NDP?
Oh, well, you know, that Davos speech, I think, rightly got a lot of attention. It was nice to hear a grown-up in the room. He's an urbane, intelligent guy, Mark Carney. But there's been a stark gap between those words and the reality. Canada's Liberal government has utterly failed to condemn the genocide in Gaza. The NDP has been really clear on the moral rupture, the tearing at the fabric of humanity that represents the human experience for all of us and a huge majority of Canadians watching a live stream genocide. The Liberals have claimed they have an arms embargo on Israel, and yet there's vast loopholes where we sell arms to the United States and their arms washed and delivered to Israel. When Israel and United States started the reprehensible, illegal attack on Iran that has destabilized the entire world, Mark Carney, in the first hours, praised that attack and played up the Iran nuclear threat, which we know there's not a shred of evidence for. And so there's a really harsh contrast between the Davos speech, which really did speak to a desire for a more level and clear political perspective, and the actual actions of the Canadian government. So, the other thing is, like, yesterday Carney announced a sovereign wealth fund as a way to fund these major projects. We are in the mood to do big things in Canada, but these huge extractive projects with this new sovereign wealth fund, which is going to be unlike Norway's, which is, you know, is now over $2 trillion worth because they harvested through public ownership in the oil industry. They harvested royalties and profits and saved them and redistributed them to build their social safety net. Canada has done the exact opposite. We ship 97% of our oil and gas straight to the United States. It's come down a tiny bit, but that's been the historic figure. And foreign corporations, our oil industry is still 60% U.S. owned. And a lot of these extractive projects, the profits are going to go straight to U.S. and other foreign corporations. But that's what we're doubling down on under Carney. This sovereign wealth fund is a great example of the Liberal doublespeak. He references Norway. It's a completely different model. It's another public-private partnership where they're going to put $25 billion of public money into a fund that's supposed to attract massive amounts of private capital. But what they're really doing is de-risking these big projects like a new oil and gas pipeline, which has no private sector proponent in Canada. They're going to do it anyway. to achieve political peace with Alberta, which has never actually been achieved, despite the fact that we already bought them a $40 billion pipeline at public expense. They're going to do it all over again. They're going to put public money behind it. And this is the direction. We're saying we need a new direction for the Canadian economy. We have been connecting climate action with addressing the cost of living emergency. So we've been advancing a whole bunch of concrete solutions, like a heat pump in every home, a whole new industry, manufacturing jobs, using Canadian steel that we can't sell to the United States because of Trump's tariffs. In order to slash people's household bills for heating in Canada, which are significant, and slash emissions at the same time. An electric bus revolution to reconnect this vast country, to save our auto industry, which is so entwined with the U.S. and Mexico under NAFTA and now CUSMA, that we're really, really in an existential spiral with the auto industry in Canada. We need public ownership to put people back to work, to reconnect our country, to build an independent economy. And more than anything, we should be investing in the economy of care, where most of the biggest sector by employment in Canada, healthcare, education, long-term care, childcare, these dominated by women, this industry underpaid and undervalued, is the actual social fabric, the ties that bind us together in communities. You get way more economic benefit when you invest in care. And we need to pay women workers more and actually support what holds Canadian society together. We've got a very strong alternative offer that speaks to Canadians. And we still have a lot of work to do to kind of surface the contradictions and the Carney story. He is a smart guy and he's very popular right now. But we think that these programs are going to fail because they're doubling down on the same old thing that got us in this mess in the first place.
Avi Lewis, we want to thank you so much for being with us, the newly elected leader of Canada's New Democratic Party, speaking to us from Ottawa. I'm here in Toronto for Hot Docs, for the screening of the new documentary, Steal This Story, Please. It will be screening tonight at 6:30. People can check our website at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! Coming up, ministers from more than 50 countries are gathering in Colombia for a major summit on transitioning away from fossil fuels. Stay with us.
Me dijiste, me querías. Me dijiste que me amabas. Me dijiste que era linda, que la rosa no bastaba, que Neruda no alcanzaba. Me dijiste, me querías. Me dijiste, me adorabas. Me dijiste que era linda, que mis ojos un museo.
Honduran musician Carla Lara performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman in Toronto, Canada. Juan Gonzalez is in Chicago. What will it take to transition world economies away from fossil fuels? On Friday, more than 50 countries began gathering in the Caribbean coastal city of Santa Marta, Colombia, in a groundbreaking effort to open another channel of global cooperation on climate change after years of frustration over the UN-led COP process, which requires consensus. The Transitioning Away from Fossil Fuels initiative was launched in the final hours of COP30, held in Belém, Brazil, last year, as fossil fuel-producing countries led by Saudi Arabia and Russia blocked binding commitments sought by more ambitious nations. Colombia and the Netherlands are co-hosting the gathering, billed as a coalition of the willing. This is Colombia's Minister of the Environment and Sustainable Development, Irene Vélez, in her opening remarks.
31 years after the first COP on climate change, global CO2 emissions have increased by at least 65%. It could be said that we have failed, but we would also like to think that we are precisely at a moment of opportunity when the window has not yet closed.
La transición enfrenta obstáculos técnicos.
The transition faces technical, economic, and let us say it plainly, geopolitical obstacles. Because despite having a science-based agreed roadmap, we are also under enormous pressure in a changing world, where decisions also end up being shaped by the pressure of war.
Several major fossil fuel powers, including Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, Nigeria, and Norway, are in attendance. The timing of the summit couldn't be more relevant as the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz has focused world attention on the vulnerabilities of a fossil fuel-dominated economy. For more, we go directly to Santa Marta, Colombia, where we're joined by Kumi Naidoo, South African human rights and environmental justice activist, president of the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative, former head of Greenpeace International, as well Amnesty International. Kumi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Nearly 60 nations are gathering where you are for the first global summit on phasing out fossil fuels. Can you talk about the significance of this moment, of this summit?
Thank you, Amy, and greetings to your listeners and viewers. To put it very simply, so that we all can understand, imagine one day you rush off to work in a hurry, you get home, you open the door, and you see water coming out of the bathroom. As you pass the kitchen, you pick up the mop, you go to the bathroom, you open the door, and you say, oh, in rushing to work, you left the stopper on, and the water's, filled up and was now flowing into the passageway. What do you do first? Do you start mopping the floor first, or you turn off the tap? So the frustration comes from 30 years of mopping up the floor and not addressing the root cause of climate change, which is our dependence and addiction to fossil fuels, which is at least more than 75 to 86% of the problem of what's driving climate change. So we have been together at many climate negotiations, and you'll remember in Copenhagen in 2009, we asked for a fab deal, not a fabulous deal, but a fair, ambitious, and binding deal. And each year what we get is a flab outcome full of loopholes, and I'll leave it to the imagination of your audience to say what the B stands for. So eventually now we are saying that we have to take the process of the most ambitious countries who accept the science to actually come together and provide leadership where we are not constrained by the reality of the climate negotiations where you need absolute consensus. So that's where the conference comes in. It's inspired by other moments in history where progress outside formal UN processes, just to take an example, the landmine treaty, for example, was negotiated completely outside of the UN system and then brought into the UN system, and then with the overwhelming number of countries actually supporting it. So this gathering in Santa Marta is about breaking the deadlock, creating a space where ambition is not held hostage and where real pathways to phase out fossil fuels can be discussed openly and honestly.
Now, Kumi, in the gathering at Santa Marta, there are still major nations that skipped the summit, including China, India, and Russia. Can you talk about the significance of countries like this not attending, even though many would argue that China has made tremendous strides in moving toward a renewable energy, more than many people expected?
So we expect dominant nations to join at once this momentum gets going. Like, so for example, we would not really find it helpful to have the United States at the negotiation at this conference right now, because the United States government, acting against the interests of its own citizens, as they have done for decades now, will come there and block any progress because they are so beholden to the fossil fuel industry oligarchs, and they serve those interests rather than serve the interests of the American people or people in the world at large. So we are seeing now leadership coming from the most ambitious countries and those that don't contest the science, those that are not saying drill, baby, drill, and so on. So bottom line is, there was Field of Dreams by Kevin Costner. You remember the movie where the tagline was, if you build it, they will come. So we are building a undeniable science-based vehicle to move us forward. And we would rather the dominant nations like the US, like Saudi Arabia, like Russia and so on, don't actually come now and contaminate the conversations and bring down ambition as they have done repeatedly year in, year out at the climate negotiations.
Naidu, Hormuz is a checkpoint, is a really a choke point for a fifth of the world's oil, now war zone. How do you convince nations like India that building more renewables is safer and more reasonable than digging up more of their own coal, and countries like the U.S.?
Well, I think President Trump is actually an accidental advocate here for phasing out of fossil fuels. It's not a secret. We've known it for decades, right, that fossil fuels is the biggest conflict driver and the biggest driver of war. On a lighter note, you might remember that the horrific violation of international law when the Iraq invasion happened was called Operation Iraqi Freedom. Evidently, it was called Operation Iraqi Liberation, which spelled oil, and then they changed it to Operation Iraqi Freedom. So basically, most people know that these wars are driven by fossil fuel interests. And I think this terrible invasion of Iran that has happened and this attack basically has sent a message to many people, including in India and elsewhere, that fossil fuels is not a safe way to be able to secure your energy needs. And I think that overall, what we are seeing, conversations happening on the ground, the advocacy of social movements to push the governments, is actually getting some currency because of the exposure of our dependency. Imagine if one strait can shut down fertilizer, can shut down, drive up costs of fuel and so on. Is this the system we want to live on with this level of vulnerability? I believe most ordinary people in the world want to break away from that system. And that's why we are optimistic that more people will be with us now to phase out on the fastest possible timeline, in the fairest possible way, from fossil fuels. And we are seeing that shift happening in public opinions, accelerated by the anxieties over the shutting down of the Strait of Hormuz.
And Kumi, we just have about a minute, but the conference is scheduled to last until April 29th. What single concrete outcome would make you declare this summit a real success?
So one, that there is no question. After this, we will get the focus on fossil fuels in a fundamental way. So it needs to have a basis of a fossil fuel phase-out plan that even the COP process will not be able to ignore. But we already have an in-principle agreement, which is that in the first quarter of next year, irrespective of what happens in Turkey, we'll have the second fossil fuel phase-out conference. And if this year lays the basis, which we hope it will, to actual negotiations starting by the most ambitious countries. That would be not obviously immediately, but in the course of next year, will be the best possible outcome from this conference.
Kumi Naidu, thanks so much for being with us. South African human rights and environmental justice activist, president of the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative, speaking to us from Santa Marta, Colombia. And that does it for the show. I'm in Toronto for the Hot Docs Film Festival, where the new documentary about Democracy Now, Steal the Story, Please, is being featured in the festival's Big Ideas program. I'll be joining one of the film's directors, Tia Lesson, for a conversation with the award-winning Canadian journalist and filmmaker Michelle Shepard tonight in Chicago, in Toronto. Juan will be in Chicago tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
You know why you listen to this station. It plays new music, supports your community, and provides up-to-date news that you know you can trust. And unlike other stations, the people who work and volunteer here are a part of your community. Remember, though, they do this on a shoestring budget. The solution is the Community Radio Initiative. You can find out more details at mycri.ca. In just a few clicks, you can generate an email to send to the politicians who need to hear your message. mycri.ca.